Welcome to the Science Podcast for January 6th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, parallel evolution and genetic assimilation in ants, Ohm's law at the atomic scale, and the ongoing search for the link between obesity, diabetes, and cancer, plus a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Rare, anomalous traits like snake fingers and bird teeth are certainly considered to be weird and unexpected. But a team of scientists led by Ehab Abouhaif of McGill University has unlocked a pattern that explains some anomalies as the reemergence of ancient ancestral traits. Through their work with diverse ant species, Abouhaif and his team reveal that super soldier-like traits can lay dormant for millions of years and be induced by exposing larvae to an overdose of a naturally occurring hormone. Abouhaif spoke with me about the work and began by explaining just how the ant caste and subcaste system works.
There are about 15,000 species of ants known today, and usually you find a single worker caste with some variation in the size, but on several occasions, the worker caste has expanded and diversified into multiple subcastes. For example, in the hyperdiverse ant genus Phidolae, all species have a minor worker caste that basically forages and takes care of most tasks within the nest, and then soldiers that actually act in defense. And in other ant species like army ants, you've got as many as 16 subcastes.
And then one of these subcastes is even referred to as super soldiers, but not all species have this subcaste. What's the story there?
The reason I refer to this ant genus, Phidolae, as a hyperdiverse genus is because it's one of the most speciose genera, period, of all animals. And what's thought to really drive this diversity, of course, is the evolution of these discrete subcastes. So in all Phidolae, you find, with one exception, a minor worker caste, which is quite small, small head, and then a soldier caste, which is larger than the minor workers and has a rather large head and sort of mandibles. But very interestingly, in southeast Arizona and northern Mexico, out of about the 1,100 species known of Phidolae, there are 8 species that have evolved exclusively in this region and are known as super soldiers because they essentially look like soldiers, but they're much larger and they even have larger heads and a larger body and they have massive mandibles. One of our collaborators in this study, Ming Wang, he described their behavior as such that they use their large heads to block the nest entrance when attacked by army ants. So that's basically what's so special about this super soldier caste in southwest Arizona and northern Mexico.
Okay, so some species here have this subcaste of super soldiers. What about these other species that don't? Do they have any other sort of anomalies within their development?
Well, this was one of our surprises. You know, I've been collecting Phidolae in Long Island, New York, and none of them have a super soldier caste. And one day we realized, oh my God, there's some monstrous looking soldiers there. And when we picked up this anomaly we were looking at, we realized that it looked surprisingly similar to a super soldier subcaste that evolved in southeast of Arizona and northern Mexico. And the other thing is, too, they had these little wing vestiges on them. I mean, there's not a single species of ant in which the workers have wings. So these are really anomalies. I mean, they weren't things that, you know, are a normal part of the functioning colony, but they look so similar to these super soldiers. It got us digging a little deeper, you know, into their origins.
Right. And so this is what you were most interested in, was then, you know, how these super soldier subcastes evolved and then also how these anomalies that were super soldier-like could have also evolved in different species. So how did you set up a study like that, and what did you find?
Well, there was a couple of things. We started to try to piece together the puzzle as to what this similarity is telling us and how you could get these anomalies being produced. in terms of development. And so in the Abu Hiflabit McGill, of course, we do evolutionary developmental biology. And so we took a very developmental approach to this and just said, well, if we could figure out how this super soldier anomaly produced, I think we could figure something about the evolutionary developmental origin of both. When a queen lays an egg, if it receives the right sort of photoperiod and temperature cues, it becomes a queen. If not, that egg develops into a worker. And then based on nutrition, during the last larval instar, if it gets the proper nutrition, it develops into a soldier. If not, it develops into a minor worker. And these switches during development are governed by a hormone called juvenile hormone. And so we had a good understanding of, in the normal case, how queens, minor workers, and soldiers are produced. And so once a larvae becomes a soldier, what distinguishes it from a minor worker is essentially it's larger in size, and it just develops this large vestigial wing disc. And so that got us zooming in on exactly those two sort of features in development.
So that's fascinating. So these larvae actually laid sort of identically, but that it's environmental factors that determine what kind of ant they'll evolve into.
Yeah.
So how does all of this tell you about how these super soldier ants evolved within this genus?
Well, two things. So then we look for two species, Phidoli obtuso spinosa and Phidoli rhea. These are two species which have naturally evolved super soldiers. And they make up about 4% of the colony, and they have a function in defense. We figured if we look at their development, we should find that relative to the soldiers, they should also have an elaborated size during development and also an elaborated wing disc pattern, if our predictions are correct in terms of development. And that's exactly what we found. And so that was the first part of our prediction. And then we went on to try and figure out, well, okay, it's really odd out of this 1,000 species that all of these super soldiers would just occur in one region. So it was likely that they just sort of diverged from a common ancestor. But then we were surprised again because when we reconstructed their phylogeny, these two species that we had sampled are actually quite distant on the tree. And so really it's a case evolutionary biologists would call parallel evolution. Because using the same developmental programs to evolve things in very different parts of the tree on separate occasions.
And you, in your paper, you bring into the term genetic accommodation here, or genetic assimilation. How did that play a role?
What tipped us off is some of these pioneering studies when they were first figuring out, you know, how these switches are governed. And they discovered that it was juvenile hormone. When they were applying the hormone, they always could switch between minor worker and soldier. And there was something interesting sort of in the background of those studies that whenever you used slightly higher dose of hormone, you would produce slightly larger individuals. So that immediately got us thinking, well, okay, maybe we could do this in any species. And so we went to the same species where we found the anomaly, and we applied hormone during a critical period in development, slightly higher doses. And then, amazingly, we were able to induce super soldier development. And these are species, of course, that lack a super soldier cast. They don't have them. And, of course, interestingly, when you induce them, you also induce the development of really large larvae, like you do in the natural case, and you also get these massive vestigial wing discs. You are also turning on the same kinds of genes. And so, really, we were convinced that you're really inducing sort of a dormant program, that there's a potential there, and that if you can go to any species, you're reactivating this potential. And then when the need arises and somehow these super soldier anomalies are beneficial to the colony, selection can actually fix the constitutive expression of these anomalies and make them real. And that is a process of genetic accommodation.
How fascinating. So what is the significance of this finding in the bigger picture of evolution?
Well, basically, I would say that what we've found essentially is something very general. Going back to Darwin's time, and even before and after Darwin, phenotypes that get induced in populations that reflect these kind of ancestral traits, they're usually called atavisms, but we see them being induced in populations all over the place. And previously, evolutionary biologists had treated them as sort of the Barnum and Bailey of evolution or some kind of slips of a developmental system. And what we're showing here is that no, if you were to look at the tree and see that super soldiers are popping up all over the place independently, we would have thought, okay, they evolved de novo. They evolved basically the super soldier caste independently several times. But the fact that we can induce it in species that don't have it all over the tree reflects some deep underlying potential that goes back to the ancestor. So the ancestor must have had this trait. It lost the expression of the trait, but it retained this genetic potential. And this genetic potential lied dormant, at least in Fidoli, for 35 to 60 million years, showing that potentials can be locked in place for a very long time. And so we think that this is not specific to Fidoli. All over the Five Kingdoms, you see these kinds of potentials just kick back in. We've really not given them attention, but I think they hold enormous power for evolution. And this is something I think once our study gets published, I hope that people will be looking for these hidden potentials and their power for evolution in other species.
Well, Ahab Abu-Haif, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie. That was really fun.
Ahab Abu-Haif is senior author on a paper about the evolution of super soldier ants in this week's Science.
Keeping up with Moore's Law, the prediction that the number of transistors on a chip will double every 2 years has proven increasingly difficult as scientists have begun manipulating components on the atomic level. At this tiny scale, the flow of electrons is impeded by surface effects, and dopants, impurities purposely introduced to modify the properties of semiconductors, can lose their effectiveness. But, as Michelle Simmons and colleagues report this week, Ohm's law is going to have an effect on Moore's law. The team created nanowires by embedding phosphorus in a silicon surface and found a large reduction in resistivity, and the nanowires' resistivities were independent of their width, as predicted by Ohm's law. Simmons spoke with me about the implications of this finding on electronics from her office in Sydney.
Okay, so we were trying to see what were the narrowest wires that we could make in silicon that would still conduct and maintain a very low resistivity. And I guess previous results have shown that below about 10 nanometers, the resistivity of silicon nanowires increased exponentially, kind of setting a fundamental limit on how narrow wires could be made in silicon. So we were really able to demonstrate that we could maintain the bulk-like resistivity. This is a resistivity that's basically independent of either the length or width, all the way down to the atomic scale. And I guess in particular, we were able to fabricate wires that are about one atom tall and four atoms wide that had the same current carrying capabilities of copper.
Can you briefly describe for our listeners what Ohm's law is? Because the title of your paper, I believe, is Ohm's law survives to the atomic scale.
That's right. So really what we're looking for with Ohm's law is essentially we get a resistivity that's independent of both the length and the width. And if we can achieve that, then essentially we're showing that Ohm's law is maintained. And so with the wires that we've made, we've literally made them down to the atomic scale, and we found that the resistivity is independent of the width of the wire, and that's really showing that Ohm's law can be maintained all the way down to the level of rows of single-atom wires.
Yeah, because when I think about Ohm's law, I think about copper wire that you might use in your house, not something that is several atoms in a row. How did you make these tiny little wires?
Okay, so I guess there are several tricks in making the wires. The first thing is to understand what the wire is. And here what we're really using is what we call heavily phosphorus-doped silicon. So we're taking phosphorus atoms, which are from group 5 of the periodic table, and we're putting them into silicon, which is in group 4. And that basically means those phosphorus atoms have one more electron than silicon, and that allows the silicon to conduct where we put the phosphorus atoms. So what we're really doing in our devices is we're making these wires down to the single atom level. So we're literally patterning them with a scanning tunneling microscope. That's a tool that allows you to realize single atom devices. But then I guess one of the critical things we're doing is we're taking those wires that we've patterned with a scanning tunneling microscope and we're encapsulating them with crystalline silicon. And that basically protects where the electrons are that we've put from surfaces and interfaces, which are well known to kind of suck up the free electrons that we put in there where we're putting the phosphorus atoms.
So when you say you embed it, you mean it's surrounded by the silicon on all sides?
That's right. So it's really encapsulated by silicon on all sides. And I guess one of the key things that we've achieved here is we've got those phosphorus atoms to be less than 1 nanometer apart inside the wire. If you can imagine, each phosphorus atom has an electron wave function. And because they're so close together, it means that all the electron wave functions overlap. And that kind of creates kind of metallic-like state. And it's this state that gives us the very low resistivity that we're finding.
It's a very, very tiny wire.
It is, yeah.
So I think a lot of people are used to the laws of physics kind of breaking down at this juncture between what we see in everyday life and the atomic or quantum level. Is that what you were expecting to see?
I guess, to be honest, we were expecting to see it, because you can imagine if you can get those phosphorus atoms close enough together, you should be able to create this metallic-like state. But having said that, a lot of other people have tried making these wires very, very small, and they found that the wires stopped conducting. So whilst it's kind of, I guess, theoretically predicted that you should be able to see it, a lot of people have had trouble. And that's really because they have these surfaces and interfaces that, like I say, suck up those conducting electrons in the core of the wire.
So now that you've been able to construct such a tiny wire that is able to conduct, in what contexts will this have the biggest impact?
Well, so I guess a couple. I guess the first one is it really shows that Moore's law is maintained all the way down to the level of single atoms. So Moore's law is obviously the law that really guides the silicon microelectronics industry. And this really shows that you can make these wires very, very small, and they still conduct and have very low resistivity. So for kind of classical computing, it's going to be useful to show that really you can push transistor devices all the way down to the level of single atoms. And I guess that's the second field where it's likely to have a big impact, and that's the field of single dopant atom devices for either quantum computing or solartronics. And that's a field that's really growing rapidly at present, and something that here in Australia we're working very hard towards is the realization of a scalable silicon-based quantum computer.
Well, can you describe just a little bit about how this would fit in with quantum computing?
Yeah, sure. So ultimately in the quantum computing world, certainly the approach that we're following is we're taking a single phosphorus atom and we're using that electron on that single phosphorus atom, the electron spin as the quantum bit or the qubit. And so for a scalable silicon quantum computer, we need to be able to address that single electron. And that really means that we're getting to the point now where the actual electrodes that we bring in to kind of control and manipulate that electron have to be the same size as the atom itself. So we have to be able to take these wires all the way down to the atomic scale.
Well, Michelle Simmons, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much. All the best.
Michelle Simmons and her colleagues report on Ohm's Law at the atomic scale in this week's Science.
For decades, the volume of studies relating obesity to other ailments like diabetes and cancer has been steadily increasing. More recently, that research has illuminated new key players, insulin and a related hormone known as insulin-like growth factor. Science contributing correspondent Gary Taubes spoke with me about the state of this research and the questions that remain.
This story is about the association between obesity and cancer, the fact that if you're obese, or actually diabetic obese, if you've got metabolic syndrome, you have a higher risk of cancer than if you're lean and healthy. And this observation has been around for quite some time, and we discuss the most obvious link connecting obesity, diabetes, and cancer, and that's elevated levels of insulin and a hormone called insulin-like growth factor.
Now, this subject area has been in the news for decades, and it has been a subject for debate at certain points. Now, just how definitive is the link between obesity and cancer at this point?
Well, the link is clear. I mean, there are probably dozens of studies that demonstrate it now, and studies, like I said, that demonstrate a link between diabetes and an elevated rate of cancer. That's not controversial. Those studies, though, tell you nothing about causality. Those are just association studies. So if there's any controversy, it would be about what the causal pathway is that makes people who are obese or diabetic have this higher risk of cancer.
Okay. And then which types of cancer in particular are being related to obesity and diabetes?
Well, that would be breast cancer, colorectal, endometrial, renal cell cancer, adenocarcinoma in the esophagus in particular. And as the sources point out in the story, the list is growing.
Now, you are talking specifically about insulin and insulin-like growth factor now at this point, that these are being implicated in this link. So what research has led to these two hormones in particular?
One of the most fascinating aspects of researching this story was the realization that insulin had been linked to cancer as a tumor promoter in the 1960s, and in fact, one Nobel laureate had done that research, even though that had not been why he won the Nobel Prize. And insulin is a hormone that's implicated in diabetes, and anyone who wrote about insulin and cancer did in the diabetes literature, and it never actually moved into the cancer literature until the past decade, especially when this link between obesity and cancer was noticed. And then insulin and insulin-like growth factor and their ability to promote tumor growth, the fact that, for instance, breast cancer cells have insulin receptors, whereas healthy breast tissue does not, the fact that tumor cells often upregulate insulin-like growth factor receptors and insulin receptors, all of this started to be noticed by the cancer community. And then it kind of crystallized when an enzyme known as PI3 kinase was identified both as a regulator of insulin sensitivity in cells and as an oncogene. And then this whole field started to really blossom.
And so these were found then to, as you said, promote tumor growth. They're tumor promoters. Physiologically, how far have we come in understanding exactly which pathways would be responsible for that?
Well, the pathways are pretty clear because you have this insulin signaling pathway and the IGF pathway, and then they link into other tumor-related pathways. And pathways that basically evolve, so the thinking goes, to monitor fuel supply in cells, a fuel supply in the body. And where there's controversy, though, is, you know, again, what happens in these fields is fascinating. There's a small pocket of people growing every day who study insulin and insulin-like growth factor and the effect on cancers, but it's still small. And a lot of the rest of the field of cancer researchers who have been doing more traditional cancer research really remain relatively naive to this research. So the question always is, how important is it? And then, you know, another thing insulin and insulin-like growth factor does is it suppresses cell suicide. And it's assumed that cell suicide programs, apoptosis, is necessary to suppress cancer growth and to kill off incipient tumor cells. So there's still some debate in that sense between the people who are aware of this research about what the ultimate mechanism is.
Now, I think it's particularly interesting that you mentioned that there were two sort of isolated fields of research here that didn't really communicate until recently, you know, the fields of insulin in diabetes and then insulin in cancer. So how do these findings influence the future of these areas of research?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there are a lot of researchers now who are working to see, you know, what kind of biological molecules, drugs can they come up with that will suppress signaling in this insulin pathway. The idea is that there are two ways you could spur tumor growth, and you could do it either by raising insulin levels in the body. So one of the things you want to look at is ways to suppress insulin levels in the body, and there's already a drug that we discuss in the story called metformin that's used for diabetics. It's an insulin-sensitizing drug, and it lowers insulin levels in the body, and there's evidence that in diabetics it works to suppress cancer growth, and that's something that's being studied actively in very large clinical trials. So you can go after insulin levels in the body, or you can go after this insulin signaling pathway. Once mutations in this pathway activate it, independent of what's going on in the rest of the body, then you've got tumor growth being driven by the mutations, and you want to figure out, you know, what kind of molecule, what kind of drug can we get in there and suppress the pathway itself, just turn down insulin and IGF signaling.
Right, right. Well, Gary Taubes, thank you so much.
Thank you, Carrie.
Gary Taubes writes about the link between obesity, diabetes, and cancer in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor of Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. Our first topic, a potential new plague for the honeybee.
Right, Sarah. Well, this story is about a rather gruesome way to die if you're a honeybee. Turns out that some honeybees are parasitized by this tiny little fly known as a scuttlefly, and the fly lays eggs in the honeybee's abdomen. These eggs grow into maggots, and the maggots explode from the bee's neck. So this is not a very nice thing to have happen to bees, and it's actually a new thing for honeybees. Researchers had never seen this sort of parasitism before.
But they did see it in another kind of bee, right?
They've seen it in bumblebees, and the way they found out about it in honeybees was kind of by accident. There was a researcher at San Francisco State University, and he was basically sitting around one day looking for insects to feed to his praying mantises. He scooped up some honeybees that were lying dead outside of his class building and put a few of them in a vial. And lo and behold, about a week later, there were maggots crawling all around the bees. Kind of a disturbing scene, but also kind of an unusual one because you wouldn't expect maggots to come out of honeybees. So what his team did was they did a little bit more research. They took real live honeybees, put them in a clear plastic box in the lab, and then introduced these scuttleflies. And the reason they use scuttleflies is when they analyzed the maggots they had found, it turned out that these maggots belonged to the scuttlefly, which is this tiny little fly. And when the researchers were looking at these two species interact in the lab, what they saw was the scuttlefly is basically chasing the bees around, landing on them, and laying eggs inside of them.
So I mentioned this might be a new plague. It's not a plague now, but where have they found these kinds of infections?
Well, they did some DNA analysis, and they found that hives both in South Dakota and the Central Valley of California seem to be infested with these scuttleflies. And this is an interesting route because honeybees are trucked between these two locations, so it could suggest that the flies are sort of following these bees around from the two locations. The big concern here is something called colony collapse disorder, which has been in the news for the past couple of years. And this is basically a condition where bees in mass will basically abandon their hive, and then the hive dies. And this can cause huge ripple effects throughout the bee population. Now, the researchers say that with this new infestation they found, there's no evidence yet that these scuttleflies are behind any of the cases of colony collapse disorders. The hives that they looked at, only about 5 to 15% of the bees were infected, which is not high enough to cause the whole hive to collapse. But it's something they're definitely keeping their eyes on.
Okay, so we're going to have to keep an eye out for that threat to the honeybee.
Right.
Up next, we have what leaping lizards and cars with tails can tell us about velociraptors.
Right. This is a cool study about what is the importance of having a tail. Now, obviously, a lot of creatures have tails, and scientists have speculated that tails function in everything from balance to fighting. But it's hard to figure out what a tail was used for when you're dealing with an extinct group of animals like dinosaurs. And that's where the lizards come in. Researchers, even though dinosaurs and lizards aren't really that closely related, they both seem to have tails and kind of similar conformations and similar lengths. And the question was, what did a lot of these dinosaurs do with their tails? And one of the dinosaurs they were really interested in is this dinosaur named Velociraptor, which if you've seen Jurassic Park, was a particularly nasty dinosaur which hopped around and had this tail. Of course, we're not sure exactly how they were depicted in the movies, if this is actually how they behaved in real life, but we do know that they had these long tails. And the question is, what were they using these tails for?
Right. And so velociraptors are pretty big. Did they use a comparably sized lizard?
They did not. They used something called the red-headed Agama lizard, which is about the size of a small rat. The reason they use this is because, again, they felt like the ratio of the tail size to the body size was comparable to what you might see in something like a velociraptor. And then, as you can see in some videos we've got on our site, they actually ran these guys, these lizards, through some obstacle courses. They had them run and jump off of objects, and they had them take off from surfaces that range from really slippery to more sandpapery. And what they found was that in takeoffs and landings where these lizards really needed to sort of control themselves, they were really flipping their tail around a lot, or they were lifting it up in the air, suggesting that the tail was giving them some sort of balance in the air. And when they tried something similar with a robotic car, which is about the same size of the lizard, they created this car that had a tail on it. You can actually see a picture and a video on the site as well. When they disabled the tail, these cars, when they would take off or land in very technical ways, when they do technical jumps or landings, if the tail was disabled, these cars were just spinning out and crashing, and it was kind of an ugly scene. But when these cars were able to use their tails and lift their tails up in the air while they were flying from surface to surface, they had much more controlled landings, and they weren't crashing nearly as much.
So this study tells us a little bit about velociraptors, but what about robots? I mean, this car is kind of like a robot, right?
Right, exactly. And, well, so this study suggests that this is what velociraptors were using their tails for, because they were probably pretty active creatures and jumping around a lot. The tails probably helped stabilize them. But from dinosaurs to robots to the modern world, researchers are always constantly trying to refine robots. They're especially interested in robots that could move very quickly, that could run and jump, that might be useful for search and rescue operations. And obviously, the more technical things you've got your robot doing, and if you've got your robot leaping around or moving at very high speeds, you obviously want it stabilized as much as possible. And that's where a tail would come in.
So should we look for cars with tails?
I don't know about automobiles with tails, but you might, you know, in the next few years, see some pretty advanced robots with tails.
Okay. Finally, we have a finding that was a long time coming. Scientists have found a moon mineral thought only to exist on the moon in Australia.
Right. This is a mineral known as tranquilityite. And it has about 20 letters in it. I'm not actually sure that's correct, but it's pretty hard to pronounce. But you can actually see the word spelled out on the site. They call it tranquilityite because it was found in the Sea of Tranquility on the moon. This is where Apollo 11 astronauts, the first astronauts to visit the moon, spent some time. And when they came back to Earth, they brought some moon rocks back with them. And obviously, these rocks were very heavily analyzed. And when scientists first analyzed the rocks, they found three minerals that they had never seen before. After a decade or so, researchers actually did find two of them on Earth. But the third one, which was this tranquilityite, had never been seen on Earth. And up to this point of this new study, had never been found in the last 40-odd years since we landed on the moon. And so researchers had begun to believe that, well, maybe this is just a mineral that's unique to the moon.
So they've been looking for 40 years. How did they find it in Australia?
Well, it turns out some of the team members are actually based in Australia. So in some respect, they were sort of looking in their own backyard. They looked at six different sites in Western Australia, and they focused on rocks that didn't seem like they had undergone a lot of big changes. Heating, cooling, big environmental changes can disrupt minerals, can even change minerals and rocks. So they tried to look for the most pristine rocks that they could, because the rocks on the moon are actually very pristine. There's very little geology going on the moon. And so things tend to stay as they were originally. And what they did was they found some rocks that seemed like good candidates. They did some pretty complex analysis with them, and they did indeed find tranquilityite in these rocks. You know, obviously people have been looking kind of hard before. Why hadn't they found it before? And there's a number of reasons. The first thing is tranquilityite is actually a very small mineral. It's actually shaped like tiny needles that have been pounded flat. These needle-like structures are only about 150 micrometers long, which is slightly less than the diameter of the thickest human hair. So you're talking about incredibly small things. Tranquilityite is a sort of a reddish brown color, and there's other minerals that have a very similar color. If you saw something the similar color, you probably assume it was the other mineral. And researchers don't really analyze rocks from Earth in that great detail because they're all around us and they're not that unusual. But obviously, if you bring something back for the moon, you're going to analyze it in incredible detail, which is what the researchers did in this study. And they found that when they did this and they picked the right rocks, they were able to find this very, very rare mineral.
And so now that we've solved this long-term mystery of whether or not this mineral occurs on the Earth, is there another use for it?
Well, it's a good question. And tranquilityite isn't going to solve our global energy crisis. It doesn't seem to have any big economic benefits. You can't make rings out of it or whatever else you want to do. But it turns out that it can actually be used to help date rocks, which is really important. You know, researchers go around the world trying to figure out how old certain rock formations are. It's important for fossil dating and figuring out a bunch of other things about geological processes on Earth in the past. So it could have some utility. For the time being, everybody's just really excited that they finally found it on Earth.
Exciting. All right. Well, what else have we had on the news site this week?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how octopi, I can't remember, I never remember which one it is, adapt to the cold, and also a story about how to talk to dogs. And for Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a new story about research in the Antarctic, the challenges of doing research there and the policy implications of that, and also a wave of retractions dealing with papers that have linked chronic fatigue syndrome to a mouse virus. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about the science budget in the United States and if politicians can actually get along to secure science funding for the future. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Well, thank you very much, David.
Thanks, sir.
David Grimm is the online news editor for Science. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that concludes the January 6th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.